Hi, this is Hugh Cornwell, and welcome to this Mr. DeMille FM podcast. This is an interview with Mick Southworth, UK film distributor with over 30 years' experience at the top of the film industry. I hope you enjoy the show. Hello, everybody, and with great pleasure, I'd like to welcome Mick Southworth to the interview table for Mr. DeMille FM. Mick is one of the UK's most successful independent film distributors. What I'd like to know first is, can you tell us something about your background growing up?
Yeah, sure. Pretty unremarkable educational career. That's one way of putting it. I was born in South East London, big council estate. Academically was pretty thick, I would say. But I was always a salesman. I knew that even when I was a sales boy, and I was in a huge, great comprehensive school, and they had a film club. And I had a few educational difficulties when I was young, and I just latched on to film. And I mean, I really latched onto it. I mean, I wouldn't let it go. Mm. And in fact, to such a degree where I used to, I decided very early that I knew what I wanted to do in life, because
even when you were still at the school,
I realised that there was, that, you know, films didn't just turn up at local cinemas. There was a process, and I used to go to the Palace Eltham, and I endeared myself to the ladies who worked there, the Palace Eltham, and I would play truant from the school, I'm ashamed to say, and I'd go there and I'd be probably the only person in the cinema in the afternoon, and they'd give me tea and toast and I'd watch a selection of films. Nah. Yes, it's absolutely true, yeah. And then
The film club at school, how often did that operate?
Well, that operated until they discovered and asked, well, I was 16 when they asked me politely to leave. My mother, who was a tenacious little Irish woman, she said, what do you want to do for a living? I said, I want to work in films, because I knew how it worked. I knew you had to, you know, organise the film to get to the cinema, and then you charge people for it, and then you go percentage of money back to the people that own the film, and yada, yada, yada. So, yeah, it was basically a very basic principle of business. My mum got me an interview at ABC Cinemas, and I got in as a postboy, and then I became a cinema booker.
Yes.
And they still exist, cinema bookers.
Yeah, and that's how it all started.
That's how it all started, and I knew why people were in the cinema.
Yeah.
I instinctively knew.
Knew what they were looking for.
Yeah. I think that sounds a bit kind of big-headed, but I equated it to, there's a reason why I'm sitting in the cinema. I wasn't reading reviews. I was looking at posters or trailers.
They're the things that draw people into a
they
cinema.
They still do. It's still the empirical science.
The visual thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's still empirical science is that. It's avid recommendation. Avid recommendation is brilliant. So if I know you got great taste in film, and I meet you for a cup of coffee in this club, and you say, I've seen the film, and I know you'd love it, I'm going to take that on board, because I like your taste, and I know you know what you're talking about, so you are recommending something to me that I probably will like.
Which is word of mouth, basically.
Word of mouth, yeah.
Can we go on to now, your first big question for you, really, is about what the first film you saw that really had an effect upon you.
Well, I saw Zulu, and I couldn't believe what I was looking at, to be honest with you. It was absolutely terrifying, but it was exhilarating, and the performances were great. It wasn't just people running around with machine guns. It was, you know, or planets exploding. This was, the sound design was incredible. You know, the scene where they're all behind the hill and you can hear them marching and they're hitting their short swords against the shield. It was extraordinary. And I remember just the hairs in the back of my head standing and thinking, I can't stand it, I can't look at it. I want it hired underneath it. So it was that kind of, it was so compelling for me. And it was probably around that time that I started to think, this is an important thing. Mm. You know, we can do a lot of things. I believed it. Mm. I completely believed I was there.
It's a great use of sound in this,
incredible,
in this film, right?
Wow. And it was that, I think, that with the tribal chants, the warrior chants, it was the first time I became aware that film could do this.
could draw you in that much.
It was great.
Great. Well, let's hear the main theme from Zulu by John Barry. So Mick, so you're at the ABC,
yeah,
and you're slowly working your way up.
Yeah, I was working my way up very slowly.
What time? What sort of era? 70s?
Yeah, 70s. So, yeah, you know, on that 73, 74, the cusp of when, you know, there's a lot of exploitation cinema sort of in the screen at the time. I was a postboy, and then after 2 years, my meteoric rise from being a postboy to being an assistant to a booker. And the old guys who used to work as bookers, they were disinterested, you know. And so...
Well, they weren't interested in the film.
They weren't... It was a job.
They weren't emotionally attached to it.
No, they weren't. You know, I wasn't a backstage Johnny, but I knew about directors. I knew the emergence of talent and things like that because I was so interested in it.
So how on earth did they make their choices then?
I tell you how they made their choices. Really good question. At that time, there was ABC and Odeon, and there'd be lots of other independent cinemas, right? ABC were fed movies by Warner Brothers, Paramount, and other major suppliers.
So there was no choice involved?
No, they just took them and they would release those films. And Odeon had Disney, Columbia, you know, they had other distributors. And if they refused one of those films, they could sell it to the other chain. It was like kind of a, it was like a kind of handshake deal. You know, we won't step on your toes, you don't step on ours. Now, obviously, they're clear that's wrong because, you know, now in the multiplex age, everybody gets everything they want. You know, you can't restrict people. But then it had a kind of way of working, and normally in a major town or even secondary towns, you'd have an Odeon and an ABC or a major independent. So every film would get shown. So I did my stint working, you know, in the bowels of Golden Square at ABC, and then I got a job working for bookers. The interesting thing about that, we showed in our preview theatre on the roof, on the 7th floor, Golden Square. We showed 3 films a day.
Wow.
We had to see every film.
Before you?
Well, it was an offer to us. We didn't have to play them, but we could get to see them. And because these guys were too bored to do it, I used to see, sometimes I'd see 15 films in a week.
Wow.
I mean, it's extraordinary. Yeah. I mean, a lot of them are rubbish, but exploitation movies. But, you know, my dreams had credits on them. I mean, I just was so used to watching things.
Yeah.
And I used to have to write a report about them and send it around. It's like a commercial report. And I just really got into it. I mean, it's like my body, after a film, my body left the cinema, but my heart stayed behind. I was in love with it.
Yeah.
Even the bad stuff.
Yeah.
You know. But anyway, so I started to work at ABC Cinemas, and there was another young fella there, and it was obvious that the new wave of filmmakers, Palace, had sort of taken a stranglehold. They were making some really funky stuff, you know, Companies of Wolves and Mona Lisa and stuff like that. They were making over here. It was incredible. And they'd become an alternative to the studio system. And we, me and this other guy, you know, we were thrown into this job and we were sort of controlling the cinema booking.
This is from Golden Square.
Yeah. But these old guys, I mean, I still have to call them sir. They could call me what they liked, and they obviously resented it, but I was their boss, and it was a bygone age, you know. And, but yeah. We slowly, they, you know, they disappeared, and it transformed into something else. So I went from there. We were taken over by a company called Canon, and I decided to leave because what I saw was the multiplex companies coming in, and I thought, this is going to change the land. The landscape's going to change forever, and it's never going to go back. So I decided to go and work on the other side and become a salesman, and I worked for a company called Recorded Releasing. Chris Blackwell owned Island Records. Yeah. He was co-owner with a guy called Jeremy Thomas, who was a very well-known producer, did things like Last Emperor, tons of films. But nice guys. It was a bit of a training set for them, but I did films like With Now and I, and I did some brilliant films, you know, Eat the Rich, Supergrass.
Let's pause now. Yeah. I'll play something, a bit of music, All Along the Watchtower from Jimi Hendrix from With Now and I.
Yeah.
Some kind of way out of here, said a joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessman there, drink my wine, plowman dig my earth. None will level on the mine, nobody
Okay, so With Now and I, a great success, and that did great business at the box office.
Yeah, right? Well, first, the first time round, it was seen as a kind of sort of quirky art film.
Yeah.
The second time, when we reissued, it was seen as fronting up for a video company.
Then it had become a cult classic.
Yeah, I mean, subsequently.
So when it first came out,
it wasn't particularly, it didn't set the box office alight. I mean, it worked in West End London, the Lumiere, which was the big place, and we used to show a lot of our films there because we were sort of art crossover, and you could make a lot of money at that place. Well, I say a lot of money, you know, but 70% of your money was coming out of London. Then the BFI, started to get a stranglehold on the university and college towns, so Corner House, Manchester, Cameo, Edinburgh, you know, big art cinemas in a very mainstream areas, and you could show your films there and do quite well, you know. And that was part of another stage. And another film that we reissued, It's One for Life, and Universal owned it. And they said, oh yeah, you can have the prints. We don't want the prints. We'll go back to the original negative, get a proper print, get it, not restored, but you know, make it as perfect as it possibly could be. And then we brought Frank Capra Jr. over.
Oh.
And he was a lovely fellow. He is a producer. He produced things like Die Hard. He was an established guy. This was an important film, not just for me, but for everyone. I mean, just something about it.
There's something very weird about this film. Every time I try to explain the plot to someone who's never don't know it, I start tears coming in my eyes.
It's awful, isn't it?
And I told that to a friend of mine a few weeks ago, and he said that same thing happens to me.
I know. It's amazing. I mean, if what we should have done, I think I said to the staff at the time, we should be selling boxes of Kleenex at the cinema. But I was standing next to him, and he said, no fair, and I was a bit grungy at the time. And the doors opened, the curtain, and people, you know, we knew the sales for this interview would be big. We knew the 450 seats, whatever it was, we'd be sold out. And down the stairs, because you've got to go down into the basement to get the entrance to the cinema, came a young audience.
Yeah.
And I don't know who's more surprised, me or him. I mean, obviously...
You thought what you were expecting.
No, I thought it'd be like a lot of older people who were going
reminiscing.
There. Yeah. And all suddenly, this guy who's extremely collected as a man and prescribed became really, really emotional. And he said, my father would love this. And I realised in that moment that it was a connection with his father, that this event where he goes around, he follows his father's films around the world and talks obviously fondly about his great relationship and his father's talent. But this was different. He was seeing something, an audience paying to see his father's film. This is when cinema and film is important.
Yeah.
And at the end, all these kids standing up and applauding the film.
Yeah, amazing.
Oh, boy.
So that was the main theme from It's a Wonderful Life by Dmitri Tiomkin. So Mick, you've got some other interesting things to say about some big films that have come out. And one that is on your list is The Exorcist.
Yeah, well, The Exorcist was fairly remarkable for me because, you know, you've got to remember during the 60s, horror was, it was, with all due respect, rather camp, Hammer type of stuff. And the stuff coming from Europe was pretty crazed. It was shown to us probably at the same time it's been shown to bookers and the press in America. And we saw it. And I didn't have any preconceived idea of what I was going to see. And how I never pissed my pants that day remains, you know, a modern miracle, because everything about it was, it's brilliantly done. It's a brilliantly done movie. It's so effective. It's not jump scares, although there are jump scares in it, but it's not relying on that. It is just a sensationally made movie. And I watched it, and I also become conscious, because Tubular Bells was already out, they just adapted Tubular Bells into The Exorcist and used it sparingly, but it was like kind of reference point for the time. So, you know, it was...
And they were synonymous, weren't they?
Yeah.
Tubular Bells, oh, The Exorcist.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they became sort of, you know, hand in hand.
Yeah.
And I just loved it. I just you know, I went home and listened to Tubular Bells. And I would listen to Tubular Bells now, and it still makes me a little bit scared.
So this importance of music to film, in that film, it's really highlighted, isn't it?
Yeah.
The connection. You obviously believe, because you're a lover of music, that music is really important.
I think
in
it's
films.
Essential. I
it
think
can
sound,
make or break a film, can't it?
I think so. Mm. I mean, if you get it wrong, get it horribly wrong. But two, it's part of the same thing. Yeah. So, you know, it's an experience for all the senses. Mm. You know, we're seeing stuff, we're listening to stuff, you know, we're being emotive. It can make us laugh, it can make us cry, it can do anything to us, a film, if it does it properly. But I think that period of time when music started to be used in a more commercial basis, I mean, you look at things like, I could have put Saturday Night Fever. I mean, I went to the premiere of Saturday Night Fever. That was a phenomenon. You know, the Barbra Streisand Star Is Born, every week, the cinema takes, used to go up.
Yeah.
People used to go back and they'd tell their mates, and all of a sudden the entire country was watching it.
Yeah, it was
astounding. But in a kind of more muted way, Exorcist didn't use it as a kind of exploitative thing.
No.
It used it to enhance what you're seeing on the screen. And I think that's a great
part of the experience.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
So I loved that film. I mean, it's still, I watch it occasionally from time to time. It's, and I think the sound design, even down to the, you know, the demon speaking.
Yes.
You know, a lot of that, see, it's all part of it. It was using things. It was using sound and design in a new kind of way to take an old, tired genre, because it was old and tired, into a new environment.
It's something exciting again.
Yeah.
So let's hear some of Tubular Bells by Mike Oldfield from The Exorcist. Thank you. So, Mick, you wanted to tell me something about the marketing around Top Gun.
Yeah. Basically, is that music started to become a marketing tool for, you know, for films. Top Gun was one of those. And Top Gun, it sounds, I mean, it was like a kind of jukebox, And the album kept on selling. And because Top of the Pops played a very key role, you'd have the videos, like the trailers, and you'd be hitting a core audience. The Top Gun didn't open particularly brilliantly in some areas, and one of those areas I was booking was Newcastle, and Westgate Road, Newcastle, and I rather foolishly took Top Gun off. I think I was put under pressure by the owner of the cinema chain, but anyway, I took it off and I gave it to the Odeon. The week after, the Odeon had the biggest financial take they've ever had, because the music was played on Top of the Pops.
Oh, I see. And everyone had rushed to see the film.
Everyone went, got to see this film. And I was called in and they said, what did you do? I said, I did what you told me to do. And I said, you can get fired for that kind of talk. So I said, I did what I, I don't know, I had a brain burp.
Well, you didn't know that it was they were going to show that on Top of the Pops.
No, but yeah. I probably did, because I used to watch Top of the Pops. But the problem was, I was running a cinema, and if the film don't take money, or I've got something else coming
you've got to move it.
I've got to move it.
So let's hear a Take My Breath Away by Berlin from Top Gun.
Thank you.
Now, another one of these jukebox films, I think, is Trainspotting. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, yeah. But different. This is film as fashion. This is fashion. This is about a group of people, and they're all bound together by drugs. No drugs films ever work. No. Oh, no, I've released a couple of Drugstore Cowboy, great film, didn't work. Because people go, you know what, I don't think I'm watching that. So this, they did want to watch. And it was about fashion, it was about music coming together with the way they looked, the way it was marketed. If you remember, you know, the strange orange hue to the poster and individuals being marketed, their personalities. It was genius. I mean, the guy who ran the marketing at Polygram at the time, this guy called Chris Bailey, who I'd worked with at Virgin Vision, and he is a genius. You know, he marketed it to himself as a person who didn't particularly go out to the cinema. In fact, he never went. So, but he had, you know, instinctively was a genius as well. I'm underplaying his capabilities.
Yeah.
A nice guy as well. But the, I love...
But it kept playing, didn't it?
Oh, didn't stop.
Because of the music.
Yeah, the music. And, of course, it opened the door. 20 years on, it's still got this gravitas. Yeah, people remember that fondly.
Yeah.
Trainspotting has been on stage all over the world. They did Trainspotting 2. Not sure that's a great idea. But at that time, Trainspotting was as cool.
It was.
As anything.
Remarkable. So here's Lust for Life by Iggy Pop from Trainspotting. Talking about these jukebox films, there's a film on your list, Here We Go Round the Mulberry Bush, which, could we say there's a similarity there from the 60s, this is?
I love this film. I absolutely love this film because it's a rites of passage movie. I saw it, you know, when that was made in the 60s, I was, you know, not chasing girls, I was chasing a little football around my mates, you know. So I saw it later on, and I liked the film director, a guy called Clive Donner, who made things like What's New Pussycat, and he made these sort of light romantic comedy things, but always sort of good quality stuff. He made a lot of TV stuff, you know, which was great as well. Anyway, so I saw this on TV. I loved it. I thought it was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. The performances, brilliantly written by Hunter Davis, major writer in the UK, and, you know, of a young British cast. But what I really loved was the soundtrack, Spencer Davis and Traffic. I think they did all of it, basically.
Yeah.
And it was that kind of period of time when, you know, you were getting these psychedelic albums, you know, being released by most of the major acts. And there was something about this, the way it was kind of dreamy. It's swinging 60s. So it's incredibly dated, but it's funny and it's charming, and the music is brilliant. I just loved it.
And there were a few hits.
Who had been hits or were hits. Yeah, they was. I mean, this is a bit previous. I mean, you've got to remember that music, you know, in the 60s, had been up to that time, it would be Cliff Richard and the Shadows on Summer Holiday and things like that. It would be, you'd be taking things that, you know, acts, and putting them on the big screen, and it would just be like it's for people who can't get to see them in concert.
Yeah, the film was just supporting the music.
Correct.
So the scripts could be weak or the stories, it didn't matter, because as long as the star was being...
Correct. Right. I mean, the Beatles films actually were quite, you know, Richard Donner did a great job on those, but they were actually quite clever and well written, and I think the Beatles didn't want to be seeing anything naff. Most of this stuff was pretty naff.
Yeah.
So you're going into an area now where, again, music is being seen as important to the film, and it pushes the, you know, the action forward, or, you know, whatever the theme.
In a supporting role.
Yeah, right, but also sometimes it becomes more prominent because the music probably does better than the film.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's hear Here We Go Round the Mulberry Bush by Traffic from the film Here We Go Round the Mulberry Bush, Clive Donner. Favourite decade or period for film in particular?
Not really. I've got to be honest. I don't have a decade of great filmmaking. I have a type of filmmaker I like.
That you'll look, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we there's a couple on my list which, you know, I'll get to.
Can I ask you about Cinema Paradiso?
Oh, boy. I love Cinema Paradiso. I think everyone should see Cinema Paradiso. This is about a kid with a dream who fulfills that dream. I mean, some of the imagery, it's quite melodramatic. The director, Tonino, wasn't it? That's it. He was known to make films like this, but this was just epic. It's a wonderful... It's a film that you can let wash over you. And it doesn't matter if you cry, and it doesn't matter if, you know, that there's no real kind of payoff end. It's just about life. It's a person's growth and what they become. It's about romance and some of the imagery in there. I mean, see it. Absolutely.
And about love of cinema as well.
Oh, it's about love of cinema. But, you know, and that's why a lot of people in the cinema industry think it's about cinema. It's not. It's about loving something, being obsessional in your life. It could be anything, you know. Being a vet, you know. But, I mean, it just happens with in this instance. I mean, that scene, again, if you're not seeing it, you won't know what I'm talking about. But with all they got the Catholic church editing the kisses out. You remember? He's kept the reel of all the kisses on all the films. Oh boy, when he shows that on the side of the wall, you know, in the square, gives me goosebumps. It's sensational.
So that was the main theme from Cinema Paradiso by Ennio Morricone. Can you tell me something about this film on your list, When You're Strange?
Yeah, it's a film that, you know, about historically a very important musical band who had a real, you know, strange story. That's what it's called, you know, When You're Strange. And I liked the track as well. It's great. I love all this stuff.
Mm.
And I just enjoyed it. And it was really, and it was probably one of the first time that actually, you know, movie reviewers and people that actually wrote off the film page, you know, on a documentary helped out and made sure we had a bit of a profile on the film because they were trying to support that as well. I think they see it's important.
And the film did very well, yeah?
It did. It did well enough. It's a very cheap movie. So for me, it's about, you know, I look at a bit of paper and say, right, you know, this is the big problem that I've got. And I have had in life is that, you know, I'm the most non-addictive man I know. I can see a film that I absolutely love, but I can't make it work financially, and I can't take the film. I know I've known people who've gone bust pretty quickly because they're in the industry perhaps for more backstage Johnny, you know, concept, and they buy films that they just love and blah 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 blah. But it's impossible to sell them, you know. It's very difficult. But on something like this, there's going to be enough of a bedrock on something like The Doors, and also people finding out about their music in years to come, it will have a value.
Yeah.
Because Seminole Publishing. So.
Yeah. So let's hear When You're Strange by The Doors from the documentary When You're Strange.
People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down, when you're strange. Faces come out of the rain when you're strange. No one remembers your name when you're strange, when you're strange, when you're strange. People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down. When you're strange, no one remembers your name. When you're strange, when you're strange, when you're strange. All right, yeah. When you're
what's the state of the film business now? What do you think now? I mean, because films are starting to be being made available now on Netflix,
yeah, of course, yeah.
And Hula, other Apple. Outlets. And you're seeing we are seeing attendances at cinemas going slightly down.
Yeah,
yeah,
we are.
But they're not going away.
No.
So, how do you see the now and the near future?
Well, we have been in a state of flux. You think about this. It was 35mm gauge, and then all of a sudden video came along in the 80s, and then everybody in the cinema side thought, it's over, because video's taken over, no one needs to see it in the cinema. People always want to go out. They do. They want to go out. They want to have a proper, you know, cinematic experience. Things like Netflix, obviously they are vying for people's money, and people have got bigger screens, better sound, all that stuff in their homes. Yeah.
Mm.
Cinema is just changing. Cinema is becoming like a community centre. You know, they're high tech. They can show sport. They can show music. They can, you know, they can be educational and work for schools. They can do anything now. And I think that you're seeing people like Picturehouse and Curzon that are starting to broaden the appeal. So you're getting great movies coming out through them.
Mm.
I think that they will emerge.
Mm.
And I think that the old-fashioned commercial cinema will be there for, I don't know, showing a new series of Game of Thrones and showing a boxing and football in areas and blah, 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 blah. I think, you know, I think the film will probably be 30% of activity on the screen in cinema in about 10 years' time. But there will be cinemas that will be dedicated to, you know, to great films, and there'll still be great films. The other thing about it is, and it's something that people shouldn't forget, is that if you're a talented person and you feel a need to write, direct, acting, or do anything really, do the music even, for a movie, if you do it and it's with Netflix, there's no profile in it. You don't get reviewed. Different for someone like J.J. Abrams doing something for Apple or Amazon, because his name's already out.
Someone's already established. It works for them.
Absolutely.
Mm. It's one case in point is, I remember in the late 60s, there was a cinema in Hampstead called The Everyman.
Yeah, Everyman.
Which was a one cinema.
Absolutely,
and
yeah.
And now they've got a chain all over the country.
They've got chain all over the country, and thank God for that.
Yeah.
Because The Everyman, the taste is everything. The audience, you could turn up with your 15 quid or whatever it is, and you don't even need to look at the poster. You can walk in, buy a ticket, go and sit there, and you know it's going to be good.
Yeah.
Because it's avid recommendation. You trust their taste.
Yes.
Because their taste is your taste.
Yeah.
You know,
well, that's a very specialised, they've got a very specialised field though, haven't they?
Yeah.
In a way. I mean, you wouldn't see a Marvel comic film at an
event. Well, you might do. If they saw it as credible, yeah, we might do. You know.
Yeah.
But the point is, the greatest film you would ever see, you're never going to see. Right? I go to all the markets. I've seen Brazilian movies 10, 15 years ago, and I've sat in the cinema thinking that's one of the finest films I've ever seen in my life. Would I buy it? No, I wouldn't.
Mm.
Because there's no one's going to turn up to see
it. So, Once Upon a Time in America, Sergio Leone's great film.
I love that film.
Tell me something about this.
Well, I was at ABC Cinemas at the time, and I remember it was, we were involved in production a bit, you know, it was EMI and they had money in it, I think. And we saw it, and it was too long. This was a kind of grimy version of Godfather. I liked the street bit of it. You know, it was like, there was something about it, but also this Morricone's romantic music, you know. He has a lot of romance in his music, yet it's quite edgy. And I love that film. And there's a scene where he's looking for the hole. I don't know if you remember, he's a little boy. He looks in at the girl dance. I think she's dancing. And then you come back and he's an old man. And he's still looking for this and he's imagining it. Again, these wonderful themes of, you know, our history and our heritage, but not ashamed to use that kind of, you know, music to capture that moment. Beautiful, beautiful film.
So let's hear the main theme by Ennio Morricone from Once Upon a Time in America. Mick, can you tell me something about what you're up to now? You're branching out into production, I believe.
Yeah. It's independent stuff. We're doing a TV series with David Barron, the producer of Harry Potter. And we also produced a film with him, Escape from Pretoria, which is a sensational project that Tim Jenkin, who escaped from Pretoria jail, clearly, and he was an anti-apartheid activist. That's wonderful. And Daniel Radcliffe's brilliant. And that will be out middle part of next year in America and UK. And we've got a number of investments into other things. And we've got the theatre side of it, and Magic Mike in London on stage and in other countries. So I'm doing lots of different things and what we're trying to do is we're working with, you know, Ridley Scott Company, David Barron, and, you know, saying it's brilliant to be working with people at that level. And we're working with young producers, up and comers, and we're trying to help them by using our network and our experience as best we can with a little bit of money to get them to fulfil their potential. So it's something I really love doing. I've always loved mentoring.
Well, let's wish you all the best for your future projects. And we're going to quite rightly end with presenting some music from your favourite film, which is Godfather 2.
Yeah, it is my favourite film. And it never ceases to surprise me and delight me. I've watched it a zillion times. And I sometimes think, you know, I'm going to watch it and I'll see some mistakes, or I'm sure there are mistakes in it. But it's almost a perfect thing. It's about family. It's about dignity. It's just about so many things that are important in life. And it's genius filmmaking. Genius filmmaker. It's beautifully written. And again, the music, you know, when I hear that music, I can hear it from the room next door, you know? If my missus, or God forbid my son who's only 11, but, you know, they put that film on, I'd run through the door because I hear that music. I want to be there. I've got to see that film. That film is a sensational movie.
Thank you very much for spending your time with us. Really appreciate your time. We're going to go out with the main theme from Godfather 2. Thank you, Mick.
Pleasure.